You're listening to the Product Podcast by Product School.
So the topic that I wanted to talk about today was onboarding effectively as a product manager. And this is the reason I want to talk about this is because for me personally, I find onboarding to be this very abstract, gnarly problem. Because whenever you're going into a new job or you're in a bigger company, you're transitioning from one role to the other or one team to the other within the same company. It's a set of unknowns. It's a very different situation to be in. How do you set yourself up for success? How do you even know what that means? How do you know you're being effective? Couple that with the fact that product management in general is a little bit of an abstract role. It changes a lot from team to team, from company to company. So overall, onboarding as a product manager is not as easy as it may seem to be. So it's an exciting time when you're joining a new team or joining a new company, but at the same time, there's certain things which I feel like we need to keep in mind. And over the past couple of years, I've been making my own notes. I've been speaking with a lot of other product managers, and I've been trying to come up with some methods and some ideas which I wanted to share with you guys today. I've moved between three different companies. Coincidentally, I'm actually transitioning right now. I was at Premise Data till last week, and now I'm moving into a different company starting next month. So the methods and whatever I mentioned over here today is I'm going to be an alpha tester for that. I'll be my own guinea pig. So it's not all words. I'm actually going to be practically applying this. So I have a lot at stake here. So to get started with this, I wanted to first describe how I want to break this down. So let's talk about why we want to discuss onboarding, what the different moving parts are there, what does that even mean? Let's break that down a little bit first, right? Let's talk about that, and then once we have a good understanding of what the moving parts are, let's think about a framework or a plan of action so that we can make sure that we're setting ourselves up for success. So I wanted to divide this entire presentation in those two sections. So why discuss onboarding? Onboarding is an exciting phase. You're new to the job, maybe you've got a new laptop and you've a new set of people and everything, but it can also be extremely daunting, right? Like it's a whole set of unknowns. This is just a set of new unknowns that I could think of. You have new people, it's a new work culture. It could be that you're going from a place where everyone was a supportive family in the culture versus it's the new company has a sports team-like culture. You could have different team structures, different communication styles, different internal processes, technical systems, business models, target user groups, everything is new. So it can be a little bit daunting. Moreover, it's experienced increasingly often. Like just a quick survey of this room seems to show that a couple of us have had five or six different jobs already, or five or six different roles already. If you dial back about 20 to 30 years, that was not necessarily the case. It was not very common to find people shifting jobs so often, especially in the technology sector. And I assume because if people online or here are audiences for Product School, they would most probably be in the tech sector. The very fact that employee retention amongst really large companies is around 1.5 years is very telling, right? That means almost every 1.5 years on average, people are onboarding to something new. And this is just for the big companies. For startups, I feel like the number might be about the same or even less than this. So it's a topic which I think we need to start thinking about rather than just having it be this nebulous concept which we'll just power through somehow. I think we need to have a plan of action, and that's what I want to kind of get at today. So if you had to break things down, there are lots of moving parts, but if you want to break things down, I feel like there are three big categories we can break things down into. There's people, there's the product itself, and then there's the process. So what does this mean? Let's talk about people first. When you think of the people involved, you have the core product team. Now, this is assuming that you moved into a company and you're a product manager for a certain product. There's the core product team. Let's take an example of Lyft, which is a fairly big company. Let's say you're joining as a PM for Lyft Lion, the product. You probably have product managers who are also working on Lyft Lion. You're most probably not going to be the only PM for that product. But you'd also have people who are working on, let's say, Lyft for Enterprise or Lyft for autonomous cars. You're probably not dealing with them almost on a daily basis, but you want to have conversations with them. You want to know what's going on in their teams. So that's the broader product team. So who else is working in product in the company? What's their agenda? What's their roadmap? It's always useful to know that. You have the core engineering team. You have people whom you'll be dealing with on an almost regular basis who are building the product. You're in the trenches with them. In particular, the Eng lead or the Eng manager, that's a person who's probably going to be your Eng counterpart. Extremely important to build that relationship. Design counterpart, somebody whom you again be working with on a constant basis. You'll have sales and marketing. If it's a B2B company, it's possible that you'll have salespeople. They have a lot of value to add, so you probably want to start talking to them. If you're in a B2C company, it's possible that there's a growth marketing team. And it's important to get a sense of who the users are from them, what the growth strategies are. Are we using Facebook ads? Are we using Google ads? What's the strategy there? So it's useful to talk to them as well. Then you have the Eng product and design leadership. This is something which I personally think that I learned a little bit later in the game. But it's really important to get a high level view of things from whoever the decision makers are at a higher level. So this could be, in a smaller company, it could be the CEO. In a larger company, it could be the VP of product. It could be the VP of Eng or design. And it's always useful to get their two cents as well. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a bit. But this is like a very high level list of people that you will be dealing with when you join a new company or move internally within the same company. The product, you have your own product. With the Lyft example again, you have Lyft Line. You have the peripheral products. You have the people who are taking care of the Lyft for enterprise. You have people taking care of Lyft for autonomous vehicles. For each one of these products, it's super useful to get to know not only the roadmap, but also the history. Because it's possible that you might have this idea going in that, hey, Lyft should just go into the bicycle sharing business or something like that. But you don't want to come in and just state that as an idea without first looking into the history of how did Lyft as a company or Lyft Line as a product get to where it is. Chances are that there are people who are working there already. They've been living and breathing that product. They've probably come up with that idea 10 times already. So it's good to get to know the history of the product. And that's always telling about where things are going to go and then figure out what the roadmap is. And if for your own product, it's super useful to get to know what the OKRs are. That's the objective key results strategy or framework that a lot of companies use in order to measure where they want to go. And also get a sense of what the metrics are that you want to measure and what historically has been measured and where are you with regards to where you want to be. And that's always useful to get as a baseline. You probably want to also know who the users are, who your customers are. That's going to be super important to know. I put that under product and not people because your users and customers are very much a part of the product and not the internal people that you'll be dealing with. You have the design guidelines and strategy. You want to talk to the designers and make sure that everything's on track there and figure out whether there are any design guidelines that you need to abide by. You don't want to go about saying that, hey, every button now should be blue in color when there's already a design guideline which says that the buttons are going to be red, for instance. Sales growth strategies as well as technical architecture. The last one is pretty important because I think it's oftentimes ignored, but it's super useful to just get some time with the engineering lead or with the engineers in the team and just ask them to tell you about the technical architecture a little bit more. It really, really helps when you're in the trenches with the engineers or the designers to know what that's all about so that you can make the right trade-offs. So that's super useful to do. Then we come to the process. What this means is every company, whether it's big or small, has different processes involved. This could be for cross-functional communication, what that means is, do they use Slack? Like a small company, a startup uses Slack a lot. Larger companies like Google, they use Google Hangouts. They just dog food their own product. So they're significantly different. The things you can do with them are significantly different. The way they use them is very different. The communication styles that people have are very different. It's possible that Team A would be using a lot of GIFs to communicate with each other, whereas Team B is more serious and they don't do that. So it's good to get a sense of what that process and what that culture is like. Do they have reviews? Do they have stand-ups? Do they have daily stand-ups? Do they have weekly stand-ups? What are the reviews like? If they don't have reviews, would it be a good idea to start reviews? If they don't have stand-ups, would it be a good idea to start stand-ups? So it's good to get a sense for what the process is like and get acclimatized in that. Bugs and ticket filing, chances are, if it's a tech company, this is already being done. If it's a small company, You'll probably be using something like Jira. If it's a larger company, they probably have their own internal tool built out for bugs and ticket filing. Data and querying tools, this is super useful. I made a huge mistake way back when I was relying on the data scientist in the company to provide me with every kind of data, whether it's small or large. How many daily active users do we have today? I would get that answer 2 days from now, and if that person went on vacation, then, I mean, I'm basically lost, right? So super useful to get yourself set up with data and querying tools. And again, it varies. In a small company, it could be just using BigQuery, or it could be using Amplitude or something like that. In a larger company, chances are they already built in their own data warehousing and querying software. So getting that set up to speed, and just being ready to go is super, super useful. File sharing preferences, do people use Dropbox, do they use Google Drive? Just getting that set up is super useful. Again, depends, engineers might want to share files in a different way. Designers might prefer to use InVision, might prefer to use Dropbox. So it depends again. So it's good to just get the sense of that and get your tools in place really quickly. Design testing, sharing tools, do you use InVision, do you use Dropbox, what do you use? It's again, good to have that conversation with the designer. Release and QA process. This varies again depending on how big or small the company is. If it's a big company, it's possible that there is a pretty convoluted release process. You want to know how many people that are involved, you want to know how long it's going to take so that you can figure out your own roadmap. If it's a small company, it depends. Whether if you're a mobile first company, then it's possible that you have 1 week or 2 week release cycles. If you're a web product and you're a product manager for that web product, it's possible that you're releasing daily. So it's good to know what that process is. How does QA come into the picture? Have those conversations really early so that you know exactly what the process is. You don't want to be changing the process by coming in way too much. You want to be getting your feet wet and understanding what exactly the process is. And if you see something wrong with the process, it's great to bring that up. So it's good to kind of get your bearings with regards to process at this stage. So we just discussed how there's people, there's product, there's process. Each one of them has a bunch of different unknowns within it. So it can be overwhelming, right, to think about all these things. And I think the key weapon, so to speak, which a product manager generally tends to have when you're dealing with an ambiguous situation is to create a framework, right? A plan of action, something you can rely on, like a set of guardrails. And you'll hear this word thrown around a lot for a lot of different abstract situations, like what's the product process like from going from inception to launch? You'll probably have a bunch of frameworks for that available online. Even something like product interviews, for that matter, right? You have frameworks for that. There's the circles method and what have you. So anything which is ambiguous, you have frameworks for that. It's a plan of action. It's a starting point, in my opinion. It's not like the gospel truth which you should follow. But it saves you from being completely lost in a very ambiguous situation. The surprising thing to me was when onboarding something which I think about a lot, asked a lot of people about, made a lot of notes over the years, but I was surprised to see there aren't really any frameworks, per se, for onboarding. So this was my attempt at kind of creating a framework based on talking to a lot of different people. So if you see any holes in this, just let me know, because I'm going to be using this next month. So. Let me know if something seems off. A few caveats before we get into the details of this framework. First of all, it's a very generalized framework. And as you would imagine, there are so many different variables at play here, the number one being the company size. I've talked about this already a little bit, and you've seen how many different points they vary a lot depending upon the size of the company. The same thing goes for the framework application as well, because the amount of impact that you can make in a small company versus a larger one over time is significantly different. If you go into a small company, you join a startup which is about 20 to 50 people big, and you join as a product manager, chances are you're one of maybe two or three product managers in the company, and you take 2 or 3 months to onboard, that's way too long. If you look at startup product candidate requirements, sometimes they even mention stuff like, oh, you have to hit the ground running. And so that's a little daunting, but what they're trying to say is your onboarding time should be low, right? But for a larger company, let's say the size of Facebook, right? Facebook has something called a boot camp period for generalist product managers coming in. So obviously the timeline for a larger company for impact is much larger. So that's the number one thing, I think, which is a significant difference. So take the framework and the timeline and the framework with a grain of salt, and definitely think of that as a starting point rather than the plan itself. So the other caveat was just thinking about this as a framework for effective onboarding as a product manager begs the question, what makes an effective product manager, right? That question in itself is probably a topic of another conversation and discussion for an hour or more in itself. But the best quote that I ever heard while talking to some other PMs was, well, will your absence have a positive, negative, or zero effect on the team? If it has a negative effect on the team, that's good. I mean, your absence matters then, right? It's not an easy hole to plug. If it has a positive effect on the team, that's really bad. If it had a zero effect on the team, that's not that great either, right? Like, that means you can do stuff, but then you're not really adding any value. So the reason I mentioned this over here is because, as a caveat, it's useful when you're onboarding to maybe every, if it's a large company, maybe every 15 to 20 days, but if it's a startup, then maybe every 2 or 3 days, just ask yourself this question. Don't get paranoid about it, but then ask yourself this question every now and then. Like, are you adding value? Are you making things more efficient? It's also useful to ask this question even beyond just onboarding, right? Like your 1 year mark or 6 month mark. I think it's super useful to ask this question. It's something that I definitely do quite a bit, and it's something that I know that some product managers that I really respect do as well. And I think that's useful during the entire onboarding process. So with that in mind, the framework that I wanted to propose for onboarding, I think of it as having three different layers. There's a timeline, like how long are we going to be thinking about this? We can't just think of onboarding as an infinite amount of time, so I'm going to time box this a little bit. Within that timeline, what are the goals that you should have as a product manager? What do you set to achieve within that timeline? And what methods can you use in order to get there? Right. So let's start with the timeline. So a good timeline, in my opinion, would be thinking of it in monthly chunks, like the first month and the second month. So from day 0 to day 30, and then day 30 to day 60. And again, this could change if this is a really large company and you have an entire a boot camp process, then maybe this might be like 75 days or 90 days. You'd have to adjust that based on the size of the company, the type of company as well. If it's a B2B or B2C company, sometimes the pace of things change based on those kinds of things. But something which I realized in the last time when I joined a startup coming from Google, and even now when I'm transitioning, is that onboarding doesn't necessarily have to start on day zero. In fact, I feel like this is often something which we don't think enough about. Like, what happens on the time when you actually get the job? Like, it's awesome. Congratulations, you've got the job. But you have, let's say, about 30 days to go before you actually start the job. I'm not saying that's a time when you shouldn't be going out and vacationing and having a good time. You absolutely should do that. But again, that's a great time to just think about the role. Think about what you're going to be doing. It's a time when you don't have any of the clutter which is going to be hitting you from day zero. So it's a good time to think about, and that's why I wanted to introduce this in the framework. I have a month to go before I start my new role, and I've definitely started using some of these concepts and methods myself so that I can kind of put myself in a position where it's not an as ambiguous a situation as it otherwise could have been. So we'll talk a little bit more about what the goals would be for each one of these chunks, from day minus 30 to day zero, from day zero to day 30, and then month two. All right. Let's start with day minus 30 to day zero. Right. You've been offered the job and you're waiting to start. It's a very exciting period. Again, please, by all means, have fun. Go for a vacation. I'm a bit of a worrier, I'm told, so I think a lot more, and so that's why I feel like I wanted to think more about how I can do to optimize this time. But the goal, in my opinion, during this time period is you can build an unbiased opinion about the product and its market fit. The key word in my mind over here is unbiased, because it's a nice time to dream. It's a nice time to think about things without the without knowing the exact trade-offs that you're going to be hitting. If you're going to be joining Lyft, going with that example again, you can think about Lyft for bike sharing. You can think of it as much as you want, because on day zero, someone's going to come and tell you that 10 people have already thought about it. You don't have engineering resources. There's no way that the executives would agree for that, and then it's going to be shut down. So it's a good time to think about those things. It's a good time to think about what exactly the product is that you're going to be working on. What's the industry like that you're getting into? What's the broader scope of things? Where do you think things are going? What does press say about the product you're going to be working on? All sorts of things, right? Like, have an opinion at this point of time before you start. Like, having an opinion about the product, already kind of living and breathing the product and the industry, having a really good idea of things helps a lot, because on day zero, the conversation that you're going to have with people, it's going to be with people who, for better or worse, are extremely biased by all the thought and all the talk that they've had for the last year, year and a half. So it's good to kind of come in there kind of being on the same page. If they have acronyms that they're going to throw at you, you'll know what those acronyms mean. So it's a useful exercise. So what are the methods that you can use during this period? Very high level stuff, as you would imagine, because at this point of time, you have no access. If you go back to the people, product, and process that we were talking before, you have no access to the people. You probably have access to the product, if it's a consumer product especially. You have no access to the process. So what you can do at this point of time is super high level, but I think it's super crucial. Number one, read up about industry trends. I'm going to stick with the example of Lyft again. Not because I really love the company or something, but I think it's a great example to go with. So imagine you're joining Lyft again, right? You're joining Lyft Line. It'd be really nice to know more about what the ride-sharing industry is like. What's new on the horizon? What's happened before? What's the history like? Is Lyft in the press for some reasons? Like, what's on their roadmap right now? How are things going? What's the total addressable market here? Are there parts of the market that you feel like Lyft can go after that they're not going after? Do you have opinions about Lyft going outside of the US because they're not right now? And if so, then where should they go? Having firm opinions about those kinds of things and having numbers by reading industry reports for especially larger companies is super useful. If you know the total addressable market, because it's probably out there somewhere in a report, that'll be very, very useful to know. Understand and use similar products. This is, again, super useful. Joining Lyft, use Uber, use a couple of other ride-sharing apps. Just get a feel for what that experience is like. Get a feel for how the product that you're going to be becoming a product manager for is maybe subpar in some ways. Have a feel for where you excel and make sure that doesn't change. Because if you as a user feel that something is not working up, or is not up to par, then that's a very powerful thing. When you join the company, you can maybe ask around if that's a sentiment which is echoed by other users, and you can do something about it. So it's an unbiased opinion that you can create during the first 30 days. Think deeply about product fit and differentiators. What is Lyft exactly doing right now? Like, who are the users for Lyft? Are they the same users that are using Uber? Are they different than them? Are they the millennials, or are they the older generation people? It's useful to kind of get that sense at that point of time and think more about product fit. You could be completely off the mark, but I feel like deeply thinking about the problem space is a big part of a product manager's role. And if you can start doing that before you even start on the job, it'll just set you up for having a good onboarding. Gather an understanding of the users and customers. This is a little bit harder to do, especially before you start the job, right? But a good way to do this, especially if it's a consumer app, is to just go to the Play Store, look at what people are saying, look at what the reviews are. If it's a B2B company, it's got some press, then you can look up some news articles about it. Chances are there are probably going to be lots of critiques talking about stuff and talking about how, hey, yeah, product A does great, but then there's also this product B that's new in the market that's doing really, really well. And then you know that, hey, this is something I need to be cognizant about. So understand what the users and customers are saying as much as you can before you even join the company. Again, you'll have an opinion. It could be that your opinion is completely wrong, but it's better to come to the first day having some opinions about the product, about the users, about all of that, rather than not having an inkling about what you're getting into at all. Super. All right. So now you've come to day zero. You started your job, you get a new laptop, you meet all these people, everyone's being really nice and friendly to you, everyone's expecting you to not know anything, but you've already done your research, so you probably have some opinions about things, you have some questions, you're ready to get started, right? This is the first month. I'm going to assume at this point that this is a company which is not super large like Facebook or Google, but somewhere in between. It's not a startup like a 20% or 30% company. It's somewhere in between. So the first month becomes pretty important because that's the time when the goal should be to get a systemic understanding of the company or organization and the product roadmap. So what that means is think high-level people and process, right, and product. Try and get as much of an understanding of all three as possible. It's super useful. The superpower that you have at this point of time is ignorance, is the fact that you can ask questions and people are not going to raise their eyebrow. They're not going to wonder why you asked such a stupid question. So ask as many stupid questions as you possibly can at this point of time. Get entrenched in the product, process, and people during these first 30 days. It's super, super useful. Again, some methods for this. These are fairly obvious methods, but I think it serves well as a checklist of sorts, just to keep in mind, rather than just having them in the back of your head and just not and just trying to power through. I've seen that it's super useful to just go back to this every couple of days and just check if you're doing all the right things. Again, it's a framework, it's not a rule, but it's useful to just keep you on track. It's useful to have to keep this as a plan of action. So some of these are not surprising, right? And chances are, since some of you have worked across like 5 or 6 different companies before, you're doing this and you're mastering these things. But it's good to keep this in mind. Number one, one-on-ones with the core team and cross-functional inch product design leads. This is the time when you can ask all of your stupid questions. This is the time when you can ask them to tell you about the history of the product. You can ask them about their ideology, about their vision, about exactly what they're working on. And as a product manager, ask them the question, how can I be useful to you? What can I do for you to make things, the process, or anything easier? How can I increase your efficiency? Because remember, if you're removed from the product and the company and it makes zero difference to them, that's a bad thing. So you want to ask people upfront, how can you do a better job of increasing their efficiency? However, what tends to happen with having a bunch of one-on-ones, especially if it's a largish company, like 500 and more, chances are the first week, 2 weeks, you're just having constant one-on-ones with people. You're talking to a bunch of people and you're just getting a lot of noise in your head. You'll get a sense of the product a little bit, but you're hearing a lot of acronyms. Everyone's on their own agenda, right? Because most people in these conversations are going to be individual contributors, and so they're working really hard towards a small part of the larger mission. So you'll hear a lot of information at this stage. So it's very important to do the second thing, which is one-on-ones with higher-level decision makers. Again, if it's a startup, talk to the CEO. Talk to the VP of product engineering or design. You absolutely should. If it's a larger company, try and get the time of other higher-level decision makers, depending upon the org that you're joining. If it's, again, Lyft, Line, try and get a conversation with the VP of product at Lyft, if you possibly can. What that does is it grounds you in the reality of what the vision is for that company. And from there, you can kind of abstract to what these conversations actually mean. And you can then start connecting the dots a little bit better versus getting completely lost in the one-on-one conversations with your eng lead and engineers and designers and what have you. So I feel like this is extremely important and something which you can set up. Maybe not on a daily basis. You don't want to be talking to the CEO every day. I don't think he would have different things to tell you every day and probably wouldn't have the time as well. So probably like every month or something is super useful. Internalizing the product history and roadmap, that's another thing which is useful to do in the first 30 days. Again, joining Lyft, understand why they didn't create a Lyft for bike sharing. Or maybe they are thinking about it. Maybe there's a rogue team of 10 people thinking about that and that this is on their roadmap. Talk to them about it. Tell them that you have strong opinions about this. You've thought about this for about 30 days. Understand what their ideologies are. You're the product manager for Lyft Line. Figure out if it's possible to speak with that team and forge some kind of a relationship there. So having those conversations about the history as well as the future is extremely important. Understanding what the metrics are is super important in the first 30 days. deeply understand and use the broader product. The key word I want to point to over here is the word broader, because again, as a new product manager, a mistake that I had made and I learned from other product managers whom I spoke with about this, that they made as well, was to focus squarely on the thing that you're responsible for. It just consumes you completely. You're the PM for Lyft Line, you're just thinking about Lyft Line. You're taking Lyft Lines day and night. You know exactly what's wrong and what's good about it. You know exactly what users are saying about it. But you have no idea how the rest of the product is working. What's the dispatch system like behind the scenes? Are there machine learning algorithms that are going to make it faster? What's going on? What's the next big thing that's happening there? How can that impact your product? It's super useful to know what the broader product is like and have a complete pulse on that, because as a PM, you basically have to be, you're shepherding the team, but you're also kind of the radar for the team with respect to the larger company. So if there's something happening in a different part of the company or the larger product that's going to have ripple effects and affect you at some point of time, you should know that ahead of the game. You should know that before it actually affects you. Again, as an example, I think Lyft created this new product which is kind of like a carpool-like system. I don't know if you guys have used it before, but it's pretty interesting. It's only in San Francisco, I think, at this point of time. But you can imagine how a carpool system like that might cannibalize the Lyft Line product. Now, if I'm a Lyft Line product manager and I'm only thinking about Lyft Line, I have no idea that this other product is getting created, I'm seeing my daily active users go down and I have no idea why. Whereas if I had an idea about the fact that this is a product that's being built, and it's not very difficult to think about the fact that this might cannibalize your product, you can go and speak to that product manager and ask them about their roadmap and how you can make sure that that cannibalization is not happening. And if it does happen, is that a good or bad thing for the company overall? So that's an example of why it's very useful to kind of think about the broader product overall and keep a pulse on that, use the broader product. I can't harp on that enough. Also, set up and use communication and data gathering systems. We talked about this before. If you're using Slack, use Slack. Figure out what the different internal groups are. The data gathering systems, maybe work with the Eng lead or the product managers on this. Figure out how you can do different kinds of data queries, and basically get that going, because that's going to be a super useful tool for keep making you self-sufficient as a product manager. That's super important, and it's very key for your success, because when you think about metrics and you can run queries by yourself rather than depending on somebody else, it's extremely useful. Set up an instance of the dev environment. I kept this towards the end just because it's something which I don't think a lot of people are comfortable with, and sometimes I feel like it's something which people don't think they need to do, which is possible, but at the same time, I think it's a really nice to have. For example, at my previous company, I was leading the mobile team there, and it was very useful to set up a developer instance on my own computer. I'm not saying that I would go in and start coding with the other engineers. I don't think the engineers would appreciate that. I think they would hate that. So you should not do that. But it's useful because then you know exactly what the logic structures are internally. And if you have an idea to propose, you know that it's not super outlandish. Also, if you have small changes to make, like you want to change the color of some buttons here and there, or you want to add a line somewhere, those are things which you can go in and change the code for. It'll go through a review process if the engineering team is running really well. So if they think that it's complete hooey, they'll just remove that. But if they think that it's worthwhile, then they'll accept it. So those things can be super useful. I think it's been very useful, at least in my experience, to set that up. And to know what they're talking about. Because if you don't do that, I feel like it increases the distance between you and your engineers, whereas your mission should be the opposite. You want to be in the trenches with them as much as possible. You want to speak the same language as far as possible. First of all, when you're having one-on-ones with your core team, is it good to ask about previous product managers, if there are previous product managers? Like, what was good versus what was bad? For that question, I think it's okay to ask that question in complete candor when you're having one-on-one. I don't think it's great to just ask about what did that person do badly, and it's about how you frame the question. Chances are, if you ask the question, what can I do to make your to increase your efficiency, they are going to suggest things which the previous product manager did well, and they are going to suggest things which they did badly, because that's just the way, that's basically the answer they're giving you. And if versus if you ask them what they do well versus what not, that's kind of going into the function of the PM. And I don't know if the one-on-ones would be able to, if those, if that question is going to give you the best answer, to be honest. What might be a good idea is to speak with that PM directly, if possible, and ask that person that, hey, if you had to do something differently, how would you do that? The second question was about setting up the dev environment, getting in there and changing a few things in the code and doing it in such a way that the engineers don't just go up all in arms and go against you. You're right, like there's you can do that in moderation. I feel like, and it again depends upon your relationship with the engineering team. If they have absolutely no idea that you're doing this and you go ahead and change things just because you had an idea, that's horrible. The number one thing which you want to do as a PM is not have anyone surprised by anything, whether it's changing the color of a button or it's a new idea or that you have a vision for and you want to socialize with the rest of the team, right? No surprises. That's pretty much like all you have to be thinking about. So if you want to change something, then chances are they would know that you have access to the dev environment. You probably want to communicate that over Slack or Google Hangouts and mention that, hey, this is I'm doing this, by the way. I hope I'm not stepping on anyone's toes, and then go ahead and do it. And if you've really gained their trust and they know what you're doing, then you'll probably know what your boundaries are. I don't think I've ever encountered a product manager, unless it's in like a 10-person startup in some garage somewhere. I've never encountered a product manager who's gone in and made huge product changes, huge code changes. I've heard of CEOs who are very technical going in and making huge code changes, but I've also heard from the engineers that they did not appreciate it. So I don't think it's a great idea. The product manager is not an engineer. And if they have a strong technical background, they should refrain from that. Similarly, just like if you're a product manager with a user experience background, you should not go ahead and start designing stuff because the designer is going to absolutely hate you for that. And they'll have a word with you later. So it's the same thing. There's everything in moderation. And I think it just depends upon what the relationship is like with the engineers or with the designers. All right, so the first month's done. You've probably got like a high level of the product. You met a lot of people. You've got an understanding of what the process is like. And now you're on to the second month. What do you do here? At this point, the goal should be pretty much setting yourself up for deliverable execution. And what this means is, as a PM, eventually you're you're measured on the basis of the quality and quantity to some extent of your execution, right? And this could be big or small, but you have to set yourself up for that execution. And what that means is knowing who the right people are whom you have to collaborate with, knowing what the product is and what the roadmap is and what you're working on is in line with that roadmap. Also knowing what the process is for that. If it's going to take a month for the release cycle, you know that you need to start planning for that beforehand, for instance. So just setting yourself up for deliverable execution is super useful. If you can execute on something within the first 2 months, that's awesome. If you're in a 30-person company, then that's expected. Chances are you've already probably launched a couple of versions of the app. But if you're in a larger company, 800 people, 1,000 people or so, chances are that this is where you'll probably start executing on a smaller scale and getting your feet wet. So again, methods for this. So you can make a list of tangible small wins here. What that means is during your one-on-ones with different individual contributors or eng leads or design leads, and when you ask them the question, what can I do for you to make you more efficient or make your life easier? Chances are you're going to hear the same thing from a bunch of people. For instance, it could be we are a mobile-first company, but our mobile release process is out of whack. Everyone is always extremely annoyed by the way the release cycle is working. So great, that's not super hard. Get the right people in the room and figure out the right release process. The engineers are not sure about what the vision exactly is, or the growth team or the sales team is completely out of touch with what the product team is doing. Knowing those things is super useful. Maybe you can set up like a weekly meeting for that to happen, and you've all of a sudden improved the efficiency of two different teams, which eventually goes towards the end goal of making the entire company more efficient. So figuring out what those small tangible wins could be is super useful. Comes with experience, right? But it also could be small, really small, tiny things which could be very useful. For instance, when during my first product stint, I realized that things were not documented at all. People were working on different features, and some features weren't working out. But there was no history, there was no traceability. The product manager leaves, and all of the knowledge goes away with that person. So I created a quick document about all of the different ideas, and it was a running stream. It was kind of like a PRD, if you will. But that was super useful for the team overall to come on the same page about. So that's one. Make a list of tangible small wins and see if that's something you can execute on within your first 1 or 2 months. The second one is active role in key team meetings. This goes without saying, but if you have stand-ups, then see if you can start running those stand-ups. If you're toe-stepping or something, then it's okay if somebody else is doing it, but make sure you have an active role in that. If it's your product, you want to make sure that you are kind of spearheading that product. You have things in control. You know what's going on. If there's someone who said something which is outside the scope of what needs to be done, then you're bringing that to attention. If the company doesn't have reviews or the team doesn't have any product reviews or design reviews, set those up. Create an agenda for that. Make things more organized. It's the more efficiency that you can bring in these small ways, the better it is. So you have to make sure that you're kind of leading these key team meetings. Another method which I want to talk about was the tools for constant user feedback. It's super useful to get user feedback, but you probably want to have your tools in place. So what does that mean, right? Like you want to know who the UX researcher is, if there is one. If there isn't one, that's a problem, because how are you getting to know, how are you getting a pulse on what the users are saying? So you want to make sure that you have your tools in place. No, the bug tracking tool would be more about just, yes and no. I guess the bug tracking tool can be a good proxy to understand what the user feedback is, but you probably want a direct channel of getting user feedback. For instance, if you're using a mobile product, you probably have something like Zendesk in there. If you're a larger company, it's possible that you're running NPS surveys or what have you, and you're asking people for their direct feedback. There could be people who are sending emails to a certain email address. So all sorts of different channels, right, to get direct feedback. If you have a growth marketing team or if you have a UX research team, it's possible that they're constantly going out there and getting feedback from the users themselves. So just keeping a pulse on that and knowing exactly what they're doing is what I mean by the tools for user feedback. So making sure that you're aware of how to get user feedback and you're not working in silo. You don't want to be the kind of product manager that says that I use this product more than anybody else, so I know exactly what needs to be done. That's wrong. So making sure that you are constantly looking for user feedback and you have the right tools in place. Because once you get super busy, especially after the second month, or chances are in the second month, there is no time to go back and start thinking about all of these issues. Another tool, I actually gave a talk about exactly this at Product School before, about how to get customer feedback throughout the entire product process. But another very useful one is to get internal feedback, especially in a larger company. It's super useful to just set up, if you're a 500 person company and you Slack, it's very useful to just set up one Slack channel where, again, let's say you're Lyft and you're the PM for Lyft Line, Slack channel called Lyft Line Feedback, right? Open to all. If you're the CEO, give me feedback. If you're an individual contributor, send me feedback. It's this democratic place where anybody can reach out to you or reach out to you over email. It's super useful to just have like different channels of feedback coming in. I can't stress that enough. It's super useful to do this within the first month or 2 months. Excuse me. Also, ideally, you should be starting to think about how you can build and socialize the product direction. So what this means is, this is a little harder to do. Again, this is probably something which you might want to do in a smaller company, but it could be something really small. Like you know that there's a feature on the roadmap and you want to just execute on that. But you have some ideas, you've spoken to the design team, you've spoken to the engineering team, you have some ideas about how you want to execute on that. Again, you should not be surprising any team with regards to what you're executing on. You can't be releasing a certain feature within Lyft Line and the people who are responsible for all of the other products within Lyft are super surprised to see that launched and see a TechCrunch article about it. That shouldn't be the case. So that's where this becomes really important. Maybe create a deck, maybe have a document that you're sharing widely, but just share that with people and start socializing that idea as much as possible. So what this does is two things. One is it keeps everyone in the loop, which is super useful, but it also kind of makes sure that you're the go-to person with regards to any questions or any concerns for that product. You become the face of that product, and by doing that, you're saving a lot of time for the engineers and the designers, because now you've got a certain direction that you're going on, that you've socialized, so everyone has agreed to that. But at the same time, if people have questions, you're the one fielding them, because it's possible, like, the 90-10 rule applies to questions that are being that product managers face, where 90% of the questions are going to be very high level, very ambiguous, and probably not in line with your roadmap. But the 10% of questions are coming that come in, and 10% of concerns that come in, are things that you need to really think about. So you don't want the rest of your team to be dealing with that, but you can be a nice filter between the rest of the company or the org and your core team. So it's super useful to do this, and the sooner you can do this, the better it is, because if you wait for too long, chances are that people just won't know who takes care of the Lift Line product. I have no idea, but I know this engineer that works there, so let me just reach out to him instead or her instead. So you want to avoid that as much as possible. So that's a list of different goals and methods for the second month. Number one, focus on the people, product, and the process. I think that's very important. Think about the different moving parts within that. If you want to follow that framework and that plan as a checklist the next time you're onboarding for your seventh job or whatever it is, I think it'll be super useful. Don't forget to ask this question, like, what can I do to make your life easier? I think it's super useful to also do the opposite and reflect upon, you know, the world where you're removed from the picture. Think about whether the engineers would be more efficient without you, the designers would be more efficient without you, whether things would be working better without you. Ask that question every now and then. And the third one is, I mean, have fun onboarding. It's a very exciting time. I think it's a time when it doesn't come very often. Like, if you think about your careers, you probably had 10 years, and if the average is 1.5 years, you probably onboarded like maybe 6 or 7 times. It doesn't happen that often. So have fun doing it. Have fun meeting those people. But at the same time, be very cognizant about how you're onboarding. Have a plan of action, especially given how often it happens these days. And just make sure that you're measuring yourself all the time, all through that process. And I feel like that sets you up for success. Another thing which I didn't mention here was, I was reading a lot about this online now as well as before, and I noticed a lot of people mentioning that, hey, if you don't onboard properly in the first 30 to 60 days, then you're doomed, and it's horrible, and you're setting yourself for failure. I don't think that's necessarily true, right? Like, again, that depends upon the team culture, but I've seen a lot of people who've not necessarily onboarded really well, who have had a tough time in figuring out the people. It depends upon your personality as well. But then in the third month or the fourth month or the fifth month, they just got it, and then they accelerated from there. So if you don't onboard really well, or you're feeling super confused at the end of 60 days, that's not the end of the world at all. You can still work on it. So if anybody reads any literature, the reason I mentioned this is because I was going to point to some of the articles that I found to be super on point. Again, this is going to be shared out. So it'll be on SlideShare as well, so you can click on these links and actually see them. So if you can't read them right now, if you're online, then you should read them later. Especially the first one is a classic. It's by Ken Norton, What to Do in Your First 30 Days. There's one by Yammer. Intercom has a great product blog. If you've not read it already, it's super good. I think they produce some really high quality articles. There's literally a book written on this called The First 90 Days by Michael Watkins. I think he's an associate professor at HBS, which is more less for product managers and more for just leadership in general. But I think a lot of those learnings can help. And he also has some frameworks within the book which you can potentially use. I think it's very, very useful to get a hold of that if you can. And there's this other blog that I read which I thought was super useful. Also, just if you have any more questions or if you see any holes in the plan that I just suggested, for my sake, let me know. because I'll be using that next month. But feel free to reach me out. That's my email address down there. It's my first name dot my last name at Gmail. So if you have any questions or any feedback, feel free to reach out, and I'm happy to answer them. So any questions? Yes.
So I actually chatted with Lyft PM.
Yeah, all right.
About the onboarding process.
Okay.
She said when she was first onboarding, there's only 2 ways for her to get a lot of money because they are in the financial issues, and she has to find a roadmap for the next quarter. So what's your opinion with that? If you don't have 30 days,
yeah.
90 days, 2 weeks, you have to produce something. What's the
question? Yeah, no, the question was you spoke with an actual Lyft PM, the example that I've been giving also the talk, and this person said that onboarded, well, during her onboarding process, part of the requirement of the job was to come up with a 6 month roadmap. Is that right? A 6 month roadmap within the first 2 weeks. Well, that's really hard to do. I don't know what size Lyft was at the point of time. Maybe it was a newish product coming out, right? I think that sometimes that does happen. It's a little bit difficult to do that, I feel like, because the first 2 weeks you're probably still getting context. But at the same time, you know, like, I don't think in that scenario the roadmap that you come up with, because I'm assuming that it's higher level executives or leadership or decision makers who have asked this person to do that. I don't think the output of that would be considered to be the gospel truth, but rather a starting point. Because it's possible that, let's say, like, this is, I don't know what the product was, but I assume, I have a feeling that the product was probably like a new org or something new, like the autonomous vehicles or something like that, where it's not been done before. So let's think about what we can do. We don't have any engineering resources on this. It's not a product which is up and running. So there's nothing going on. There are no designers working on anything. There are no engineers working on anything. So as a product manager, what do? You create a plan. So your first deliverable would be probably a roadmap of some sort. So I would imagine that at that point of time, it's a bit of an anomaly, but I would count that into having a quick set of deliverables. That's basically one of your quick deliverables, essentially. But in order to do that, again, you can't do that in silo, right? You need to have one-on-ones with people. You still need to understand what the roadmap for other products are. Because if you're creating a roadmap for your own product, it's possible that it shouldn't toast up on other products, for instance. So you still have to follow a lot of those different rules, but also think about the roadmap for your own product as quickly as possible. So it's challenging, but it sounds like it could be possible. How do you get from a software engineering role into product management? I think that's actually a question which there's a lot of online literature about, but I can try and answer that. And the answer is obvious. It's more often than not, you'll see people transitioning internally if there's a possibility of that happening. If it's a super tech-oriented company, then they'll appreciate you being a tech-oriented product manager. You can join a startup, which is super small, and you can join that company as a product manager. It's easier to transition into product management, I think, at a smaller company than a larger one. Larger companies tend to have more process around that. So I think that's one. The other one is obviously getting a business degree and that kind of stuff in order to pivot in your career. But it's a very expensive option to consider, but it is an option to consider. But there is no, I don't think there is one or two or three different ways. I feel like the question to that answer gets 100 different responses. Just like if you ask someone what is a product manager, it gets 100 different responses. So it depends. My undergrad was kind of in a mix of design and computer science. And my master's was in the School of Computer Science. I went to Carnegie Mellon. That's when I went to grad school. I was actually interested in more on the user experience HCI side of things, and that's when I applied for my first job. But after the interview, this was about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe more. And at that point of time, product management hadn't become as big as it is now. It wasn't as popular as it is now. I had not heard of it. So the recruiter called me back and said that, hey, instead of design, we want you to join as an associate product manager. I say, I have no idea. I want my design role. And but then I talked to the hiring manager about that, and that's how I kind of got into product. I then joined Google. I was adamant to work in UX. I joined Google with the Android team. It was still new, and so I joined the team as a UX person in their design team. And it was when the material design concept was coming up, and people were moving Android from being like this super technical geeky operating system to being an operating system for everyone. And KitKat was launching, and Lollipop was launching. It was a very exciting period, and we were just 50 or 60 designers, so very, very interesting to join that team of people. So I worked at Google in that team in design for about a year and a half or so, and then transitioned internally into product management. Google has many different ways, again, that you can do that. If you don't have much experience, you can join the APM role. If you are from an engineering background or something, you can kind of do this rotation program within the company, or you can just interview, which is what I did. And then for the last year and a half, or year, 7 months, I've been at a startup called Premise Data. Brandon mentioned, I've been leading the mobile team over there, and yeah, I actually just left last week, so that's my background.
So, based on your experience, how easy or difficult is somebody from outside Google getting into the APM role in Google?
I'm not sure about the APM role, to be honest, because I didn't do that, so I'm not quite sure about that. I would imagine there are a few Quora answers about that, though.
But what about the PM role? Do you see people not coming from traditional product management?
I did see that happen quite often. Not quite often. I think the bar of entry was pretty high. It wasn't that easy. But I did see people who are from non-technical backgrounds come in. But I do think they're in the minority. I don't have data to back myself there. But I just, speaking from experience, I just feel like it's mostly people with a technical background, especially if you look at the interview process, because they have like a technical interview as well. It was more in the minority, I would say. But yeah, happy to chat after the talk more about that. Interesting. So the question was, if you're the CEO of a small company, like a 10-person, 15, 20-person company or so, chances are you've probably not made your first product hire. So then what are the goods and bads there? I think at that stage, the needs of the company are very different, right? As the CEO, when you say that you're the product manager, you're basically shepherding the company forward. You're making sure there are no surprises for people within the company. You're setting the vision and you're making sure that everyone knows about it. I think the principles of product management kind of stay the same. The way you execute on that changes, because the big difference between a CEO being a product manager and a non-CEO being a product manager is that a big challenge in the role of product management is to manage without influence, right? And that's something which is a little hard to do, but if you're the CEO, then you're paying for the paycheck, so that changes, right? You have a ton of influence, so that changes things quite a bit. So sure, you're the CEO and you call yourself the product manager because you're doing all those things, but that fact changes things quite a bit. So like between the user experience and between the information architecture, which one is more important? I mean, I think both of them are equally important, yeah. Especially if you ask a UX designer about it, then they would probably say that they both almost go hand in hand, right? Like you can't have really poor information architecture and users have no idea where to go and you have 10 buttons to do one small thing but the user experience is great or the visual design is great. So I think it goes hand in hand with each other. I mean, Craigslist is a unique example, right? They have so much data and so many different people relying on them that unless there's somebody else who comes in, I don't know how much user experience would play as a big differentiator there. Sure, their information architecture isn't necessarily the best in the world or neither is their user experience, but and also it's not a new idea, so to speak, to come up with a better designed, better managed Craigslist. It's being done. Like dime a dozen startups that have tried to do that, but the sheer amount of data that Craigslist has, the number of users that they have, is ridiculous. So that's their power. I would imagine you could say the same thing for Reddit as well, right? Like if you look at Reddit, it's not the best designed app in the world or the product in the world, but the number of people that they have is huge, and you don't want to change something which is working really well. You want to maybe incrementally change it. If you look at Amazon from like 15, 20 years ago, it looked very different. But they didn't just overnight change things. They changed things over a large period of time, and now it looks very different. So again, it depends on the company's philosophy, what their main motivation is. It's possible that those companies like Craigslist and Reddit just didn't think of design as something which is of primary importance to them. I personally think it's very important, but maybe they didn't want to change things. How do you get user feedback? What tools can we use for that? What about user testing? There are so many different tools. It's literally like another, I could spend another hour talking about this, the different tools, but really high level, I think it comes down to a couple of things, right? Number one is the data that you're getting in. At the startup that I was working at, we used Amplitude, and that was very useful to kind of get a pulse of like the basic numbers, how many people have used different buttons within the mobile app, and so on and so forth. So that requires you thinking about that beforehand and kind of building that into the system, that entire analytics framework, and that's super useful. You just launch, let's say, like a new feature which is going to allow users to do things more efficiently, but you can go into the actual, you can go into the system and check on Amplitude whether it's actually doing what it's supposed to do. So from a metric standpoint, that's super useful. That's one. The other one would be more qualitative feedback, like I talked about before, like Zendesk within websites or apps, Intercom. Like it started popping up in almost every single website that you go to now because they're looking for user feedback as well as a bunch of different engagement tools. For user testing, what I've found to be super useful is literally to ideally have users come into your office and talk to them directly. If you have UX researchers in the company, that's brilliant. You can work really closely with them and have them ask all the right questions the right way. But if you do not, then you can start looking at proxies. Again, at the startup that I was working at, we didn't have UX researchers yet. So, and to top that, our users were not in the US. They were in Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines. So we used different kinds of tools and apps. We became really scrappy, basically. We used something called Lookback, which is an app which you can ask people to download, and they use your app, and it basically uses the camera to see what their expressions on their faces are, and it also acknowledges the different touch points on the app. So using that, we could see that, hey, we created this thing, we thought it's awesome, but when they used it, you see the sense of bewilderment on their face. And you're like, oh, okay, seems like we need to get back to the drawing board again. So it's different tools ranging from more data-driven. It could be even like directly just go into the system and query. If you're using Google Cloud, for instance, they have a really good SQL query-based querying tool, and you can just query the database for things, or use Amplitude, if you will, versus something which is more qualitative, like speaking to the UX researchers, actually talking to the users themselves. Sending out surveys to users and how effective that is. I have, yes, but it is useful, but it depends a lot upon the context, right? If the survey is about a very specific feature, then it's useful. It also depends upon how many users you've gotten feedback from. With surveys, you have to be careful about the N number, if it's just 50 people, you're probably not going to reach a statistically significant response. But if it's like 500 or something, then that's great. I've used Google consumer surveys in the past. I think that's been super useful for very quick responses for small things. This is the icon we want to use, but does this really look like an FAQ button? And you send that on Google consumer surveys, and it does the job for you, and it'll get responses from like 500 to 1,000 people and tell you how statistically significant it is. So that's been something which has been quite useful. Just customer acquisition models, mm-hmm. and testing whether the customer acquisition models are accurate or not. Yeah. And going to be successful or not? I think that's a good question. It's to some extent it is a product question, especially if you're thinking about go-to-market strategies and stuff like that. There are different ways different companies do this. Again, it depends upon the nature of the company. As an example, if it's a B2B, if it's a B2C company, you have a growth team. They're pretty much the experts, right? Like there's a reason they're there. It's possible you're a growth product manager, in which case you know how to exactly use like Facebook ads to your advantage, or to how to use organic growth to your advantage, reducing the, have metrics like your customer acquisition cost or the LTV is, and be very data-driven about that. Versus if you're a B2B company, then you're probably relying on your salespeople, in which case you have to make sure that their pitch decks are really good. They're actually demoing the actual product. And when they're going for a demo, just making sure that they're successful. So it depends a lot upon that. If it's a much larger company, then you might want to think about go-to-market in a particular city first. And with a smaller audience, you might want to have alpha releases or beta releases and kind of be tweaking things based on that. For the large part, I think a lot of this comes from experience of launching previous products. You get an intuition for things, and that helps a lot as well. So it depends upon just so many factors when it comes to the launch strategy. But I think it's no matter what it is, you always start small, and then you learn quickly from those mistakes, and you iterate, and you grow to a larger audience.